Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Well That Aged Well. This week I'm joined by John France, and we're going to talk about the relationship between the popes of the 12th and 11th century and the Hohenstaufen dynasty. But before we begin, I want to announce that I do have a new microphone. You might see here that hopefully I will hope you hear the sound better and the quality hopefully will increase. And I want to begin, of course, by asking you, because you have recently written a new book that's coming out soon about the French military in military under the French monarchy. But before that, I wanted to ask, what is it about the popes and the Hohenstaufen? Because they really don't get along, as we will see in this episode. They really don't get along very well, do they?
No, they don't. And really, underlying it all is the very deep preoccupation with the papacy. The popes always want to control as much of Italy as possible. They couldn't create control of all of Italy. Their principality around Rome was much too small. And they were terrified of some great power arising in Italy, which would compromise their independence. So the whole thing about the papacy is to retain, expand and control the great duchy in the centre of Italy, and to resist anybody, and really anybody, who was prepared to threaten, or who they thought was prepared to threaten it. And this susceptibility, this kind of anxiety of the popes to safeguard their own independence, is one of the great themes of Italian history in the Middle Ages, and indeed beyond.
So before we go into this, I feel like, because we haven't discussed Barbarossa much on this podcast, I want to give a little bit background on Barbarossa and how he got the power. Because according to his recent biographer, John B. Freed, he was not really supposed to be emperor, is my understanding, because he never learned Latin, which was the lingua franca of the Europe at the time. That was the international language that was spoken in the medieval court, and Barbarossa never learned Latin. So it's my understanding, according to his biographer, that he mentioned that he was never supposed to be emperor. Is there truth to this?
Yes, he was. You have to realize that the crown of Germany was always in doubt in the 12th century. There was no very clearly established rule of the father being succeeded by the son. So that every time a German emperor died in the 12th century, there was doubt. And when Henry V died in 1125, the Hohenstaufen, to whom Frederick belonged, immediately tried to become elected. And they were bitterly contested by the Welf. So that when Conrad died in 1152, who was going to be king? It was up for grabs. And rather to everybody's surprise, the person who got the most electors on his side, rather like a modern election, was Frederick Barbarossa. He was important. He was a very important Duke of Swabia in the south. But he wasn't entirely expected to reign because he had plenty of enemies. But in the end, he won the election and he became emperor. And that was a great surprise to everybody. As king of Germany, he didn't have a lot of power. So he had to look elsewhere. Now, the kings of Germany were traditionally also kings of Italy. The long period of conflict in Italy had ruined their power in Italy, really. And Italy had become one of the most fascinating places in the world. It was a peninsula in which wealth was enormously concentrated in the north, in a very large scattering of cities. And those cities had come to enjoy their freedom. They looked at the idea of the German Emperor Frederick coming to rule them with a good deal of not necessarily hostility, but with concern. And the Pope, in turn, was very worried. Frederick needed wealth. Frederick in South Germany needed wealth and a natural place to expand and control was Italy, and he had a claim. So what you have is a collision of two forces. In the north, coming from Germany, the new dynasty of the Hohenstaufen looking for greater wealth and power than they could ever achieve in Germany, where they had many rivals. In the south, in the centre of Italy, the papacy, jealous of its independence, deeply worried. And in between are the cities of the Lombard Plain. I don't know how many people go to Italy. It's a lovely place to visit, but not many of them go to the Lombard Plain. And it was an immensely wealthy area. It's wealthy in terms of agriculture because it's rich and it's well watered and it has a lovely climate. So that's one reason for everybody coveting it. The second reason is even more interesting, and that is that the center of wealth in the medieval world is the Mediterranean. We tend to forget that. And virtually all Mediterranean trade is channeled to Northern Europe through Italy. So these cities not only enjoy really wealthy agriculture, but they also enjoy a vast trade, a trade in luxury commodities like silk and spices coming from the east. And the Hohenstaufen dynasty in the person of Frederick I sees that as an immense source of wealth which they can tap.
You mentioned wealth, and of course, you mentioned that he had many enemies as well. So, what's the need for wealth to secure his power against the enemies that Frederick had?
Yes, Frederick had lots of enemies. Above all, the Dukes of Saxony, who belonged to the Welf family. And they were bitter enemies. Henry the Lion was a bitter enemy of Frederick. Henry the Lion.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but it's my understanding that they were kind of close for a while, the Henry the Lion and Barbarossa. They were close early on, but their relationship, as most of the teams, that it deteriorated as well.
They had been allies of the Hohenstaufen, as most people had, but allies and enemies amongst the high aristocracy of Germany, one change, there are changing alliances all the time. And Henry the Lion, with rule over Saxony, was extremely important and a powerful counterweight in Germany, especially in North Germany, to Frederick in the south. So Frederick had enemies, and those enemies tended to group around him, around Henry the Lion. So for Frederick, it was really imperative, if he was to be a real king and a real emperor, that he sees somewhere else beyond Germany. Because in Germany, he had recognized the rights of the dukes and of the great aristocracy. He had said to them in 1152, when he succeeded, "Look, chaps, I'm not going to try and reclaim any powers that you may have taken in the past from the monarchy. I'm going to recognize your rights. I'm going to work with you. And that was the basis of his rule in Germany, a sort of consensual attempt at consensus to bring the other great aristocrats in line with him, not by force, but by persuasion and by friendship. And in that way, he would have a neutral background in Germany, positively helpful in some ways. He enjoyed the support of the German church, which is immensely wealthy. He could then create his own power base in South Germany, North Italy. So that was fundamentally his ambition. The cities were divided amongst themselves. Every city had a contado, a plain around it from which it lived, or from which it drew its food. And every city suspected its neighbours, not unreasonably, of trying to trespass on their contado. The big cities like Milan wanted to absorb the small cities. So Frederick intervened in what was essentially an Italian war. It was a kind of Italian civil war of cities against cities, and his aim was to intervene and thus dominate the papacy through its weight behind cities which did not agree with imperial rule. So Italy becomes dominated by this conflict, and out of this comes the great struggle with the papacy. The election of Alexander III was, as so often with papal elections, doubtful. It was not a clear-cut election. Not everybody went along with it. The rules for electing were not all that clear. So Frederick set up an anti-pope who he claimed was the correct pope, who would support him and thereby influence the church in Germany, which was vital, and indeed public opinion across Europe in his favour.
I want to discuss a little bit about the relationship with anti-pope and pope, because how did an anti-pope work exactly, and how much power compared to the original pope, if you will, how did the anti-pope have, and how many took the anti-pope seriously versus that they really supported Alexander III versus Calixtus I don't remember the number, but we do believe Calixtus took the name of Calixtus. But how, let's talk about that power that the anti-pope had and support from, because obviously you need this international support if you were pope and need power. So how much power did the anti-pope have, and how were the relationship between anti-pope and Rome, and how worked?
The anti-pope for Frederick was that the anti-pope could be recognized all over Germany, because he, Frederick, had enormous power in Germany. But the trouble was that this added an ideological struggle to what was essentially, up to then, a territorial struggle, because many in the German church, and indeed outside the German church, felt that the papacy should not be a plaything of kings and emperors and their politics. And they in turn influenced other people, particularly in Germany. Outside Germany, probably everybody opted for the original Roman Pope, ultimately Alexander. But in Germany itself, there was a strong support, very strong support for the Hohenstaufen, for the anti-pope. And that persisted, but it also aroused hostility. So what you have are two quarrels, if you like. In the first place, there's a territorial quarrel, the empire seeking a dominion which impinged on the territory of the Pope. In the second place, there is an ideological struggle between the power of a secular king and the power of the spiritual ruler of Christendom, who is the Pope. So the anti-Pope is a threat, but he's a threat with enemies of his own, because of course his enemies in Germany are precisely the enemies of Frederick I.
What a worry among Alexander III that some maybe the anti-Pope would come and take over his throne in Rome as well.
And he must have remembered, I mean, everybody would have remembered, that in the 11th century, nearly 100 years earlier, the Emperor Henry IV had actually besieged and seized Rome and sacked it and placed his own candidate on the throne. And that was a very uncomfortable precedent. But the papacy had its allies, the Kingdom of the Normans in the south, a lot of opinion in Europe, but above all their allies were the cities of Lombardy. And their resistance, or the resistance of some of them, not all of them, to Frederick Barbarossa. And they're the great barrier to papal dominion in Italy. The papacy stands for a divided Italy, and it will continue to do so right through to the 19th century. It's quite remarkable consistency. So the conflict between Frederick and the Pope is both territorial and personal, in a sense, and ideological. It's a double enmity which gives real bitterness.
If I may, it's kind of like a modern love triangle, if you will. You have the anti-Pope, Frederick Barbarossa, and then Alexander III on the throne. So it's kind of like a modern, maybe without the love, but it's a kind of a modern drama with a triangle in it.
Yes, and just to complicate things, I mean, the popes that Barbarossa chose were people of very high reputation, which some more accepted popes in the past had not had. So Barbarossa was very shrewd, but in the end, the struggle in Germany, although he managed to control it and was never really under the threat of being deposed, did weaken him a lot. And that struggle became entwined with the Italian struggle, which is why you have these two parties which form up in Italy, the Ghibellines, who support the Hohenstaufen and believe that their cities are best served by an imperial peace, and the Guelphs, who are the party of Henry, named after the family of Henry the Lion.
Doesn't Henry the Lion at first support the anti-pope and then later switch sides?
But ultimately he switches sides, and ultimately he turns against Frederick. He's at best neutral and at worst hostile to Frederick, who in the end deposes him. So that deposition is somewhat limited. It's more limited than it appears. But the struggle in Germany and the struggle in Italy and the struggle against the papacy, it's a very complex situation, especially as in the cities, there's great rivalries in the cities, factional struggles. And one party will say, we support the Pope. And the other party will immediately say, we support the emperor. So that you get civil wars within cities. And those civil wars, the outcome of each of them, produces who supports, which is where the city jumps in terms of support.
Whether support for the empire in Rome itself, and if you had for those supporters, was it dangerous to support Barbarossa in the West, considering that that was the seat of Alexander, as well, was it dangerous to be a supporter for the Empire in Rome?
Yep, the supporters of the Empire in Rome, there is always this struggle within cities and within virtually all the principalities of Italy as well, over which way to jump, who to support. And it mattered a great deal to them, or they thought it did. And in the end, the conflict went in favor of the Guelphs, largely, I think, because Frederick lacked the resources to impose his will on northern Italy. The cities like Milan, above all, which opposed him, they believed that they saw their freedom as crucial. And they had enormous resources by medieval standards. Not only did they have food in their contado, etc., but they had actual cash. And Frederick was chronically short of cash. And if Frederick wanted an army in northern Italy, he had to bring it all the way over the Alps.
I want to ask, was it the same as crossing the Alps in those days of Barbarossa as it was for Hannibal back in the Punic Wars? Was it more or less the same thing?
It was probably just as difficult in both cases, yes, because roads were very poor. There were Roman roads across the Alps, but the passes are not easy passes, any of them. And Barbarossa often used the pass from Burgundy, actually, because he was also king of Burgundy, in order to get into Italy. It was an enormous strain to travel any distance. Remember that if you were going more than to a local town, you tended to make your will in the Middle Ages. Just moving along a highway was a threat to life. How do you feed an army on the march over the Alpine passes down into the plain? It's difficult to feed them in the plain, it's much easier. But of course, there's another threat in the plain, a classic threat to German armies, and that's sickness. Barbarossa's army in front of Rome actually suffered from the plague and fell back because of it. So he's struggling at a distance to control people who are very bitterly opposed to him and well supported by the church, which has its own will. So Barbarossa never really succeeds in wholly dominating the plain of the Po. There are just too many enemies and they're just too wealthy.
Now, I believe that eventually Frederick, sorry, Alexander III, he excommunicate Frederick. And I want to ask as well, how powerful, but because in later 18th and 19th century, it's kind of a joke being excommunicated. But back in those days, it was taken very seriously. So how powerful was the tool of excommunication, and how seriously with Frederick's anti-pope on the throne? How seriously did Frederick take the excommunication of Alexander III?
Well, of course, he would argue that it wasn't an excommunication, that the so-called Pope Alexander had no power because he was not a legitimate pope. But nonetheless, that had to be taken very seriously, and it certainly was taken seriously elsewhere in Europe, where there was considerable concern. In England, Henry II, by and large, backed the papacy. But in the 1170s, he, early 1170s, there are signs that he was thinking that he might back the anti-pope to use him against Thomas à Becket and the squabble in England. So there were all sorts of things which could influence people. excommunication of one pope by the other. Well, they both excommunicated one another. But local factors could swing European opinion. And the signs are that Henry II of England, Henry Longshanks, was quite leaning towards the Imperialist Party at one stage. It's an indication of just how precariously the parties are balanced at various times.
I want to talk a little bit more about the anti-pope and the Barbarossa Calixtus. Sorry, I didn't forget the number because he called himself Calixtus the Third. And how did, when he issued the decree, was he basically a puppet of Barbarossa? Did he feel like he had some power of his own as well? That he was felt like, I am the real pope, unlike the one in Rome. How when he issued the decrees, how seriously were the decrees issued by Calixtus III taken by, of course, we discussed that in Germany they were taken quite seriously, but like we said, as well elsewhere, how, like France, for example, or like we talked about England, how were the decrees issued by Calixtus III viewed in outside of just Germany, and how did that, were they followed by anyone else outside of Germany?
It would be taken seriously by people who incline to a Barbarossa's party, but otherwise not. There's very little indication that there was a serious acceptance of the anti-pope. Europe, by and large, stood by Alexander. A bit reluctantly at times, but nonetheless they stood there. And the importance of the anti-pope is always to enlist the German church, but even that is imperfect. So Barbarossa always faces this ideological conflict within Germany, which does erode his power. There's no doubt about it. Many of the German princes and German population felt unhappy at various times, and they could mobilize their feelings through people like Henry the Lion, who was prepared for quite different reasons to intervene against Frederick.
So, when, of course, I want to talk as well, because you know that Barbarossa did go and eventually drown on the way to the Third Crusade, but being excommunicated, how does it manage to raise? Because we discussed that it was taken quite seriously, excommunication in those days. But so how does he, under excommunication, manage to raise, sorry, an army of 200,000 soldiers? Or I don't remember the exact number, but I believe the numbers say something along the line of 200,000 soldiers that would follow an excommunicated emperor that was excommunicated by the Pope. So how does it get to gather so many soldiers to go on crusade with him, to follow him, considering that he was excommunicated?
Well, Barbarossa came to terms after his defeat at Legnano, the Battle of Legnano in 1176. Frederick I Barbarossa comes to terms with the Pope, and one of the terms is he is relieved from the burden of excommunication. And at that point, he kind of ceases to be active in Italy. And in his later years, he doesn't intervene there very much. And then in 1187, the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem is destroyed by Saladin at the Battle of Hattin. And a great shock goes through Europe, and Frederick Barbarossa takes the cross. And in fact, the first really to get to the east. And of course, everybody accepted and praised him. The papacy, not least, because in Frederick's decision to take the cross, we see the papacy sees an acceptance of papal leadership in Europe. So Barbarossa is not an excommunicate when he goes on crusade. He has a formidable army, though much smaller than is often guessed. The best estimate Graham Loud has produced is around 15,000.
There are some sources that I believe say that it is 200,000, that this is such a huge army.
Very unlikely.
But it was, I believe, some people say that it was the biggest army of the time that he managed to gather.
It was a very big army by contemporary standards. I mean, by 12th century standards, getting together an army of 15,000 to 20,000 was an enormous task. And that's roughly the size, we're always guessing about numbers, of Barbarossa's crusading force. It was highly disciplined, it was made up. See, Barbarossa had been on the Second Crusade before he became king. He was a crusader in 1148. He realized that the Second Crusade had failed because it was indisciplined, and had too many non-combatants. So when he raised his crusade, he actually prohibited poor people from joining unless they could show that they had the money to pay their way all the way to Jerusalem. And the result was he created an army which had a very large cavalry element. The nobles, in fact, of Germany went with him, and a relatively small infantry element, though it was still a majority of the people who went. And it was a very tightly organized army. And Barbarossa's army actually was quite remarkable. Fought the Byzantines in the Balkans. Damaged very severely the Turks in Anatolia, and it fell apart because of plague. It was plague that killed it off, really, more than anything
So
else.
it's not a legend that Barbarossa drowned and then everyone's sudden that nah, I don't think we're gonna go on. Just let's just go home. That's not the case.
Well, no, it's quite clear that he drowned in one way or another in the river.
Yeah.
But
But the
his other.
legend that the army disintegrated just because he drowned, that's not true.
But the army, which had fought its way across Anatolia, was still very powerful. But as it got into southern Anatolia, Cilicia, the land of the Armenians, it became afflicted with plague. And plague destroyed it, as it did destroy many armies in the Middle Ages. But the legend of what happened to Barbarossa grew up much later, of course. The idea that he sleeps under a mountain in South Germany and will one day rise again to liberate Germany, one of the Nazi myths, incidentally, that's a rather later idea. But Barbarossa was a formidable soldier in his own way, and he did very well on the crusade. And of course, that crusading fervour, his army, as it approached, became a nightmare for Saladin. And Saladin is trying to fight off a siege of Acre in the Holy Land. All the time he's looking over his shoulder northwards, fearful that the Germans were coming. And when Barbarossa died and his army dissolved under the impact of the plague, the sigh of relief that the Muslim sources give, that God has deprived the Christians of this great leader, large sections of Saladin's army had gone north to contest the German approach. He was deeply worried by it. It had a very profound effect on the whole of the Third Crusade. And Barbarossa deserves credit for that. It was quite remarkable.
So I want to ask, and I know historians hate what if questions, but let's say, what if the army and Barbarossa made it to the Holy Land? How different would a Third Crusade have been had it not drowned in the river and the army made it to Jerusalem?
Well, it could have been very different because the German army was very disciplined and it had a very high element of very well armed and equipped cavalry. And the impact of a force from the north, the Germans, and the army, which was attempting to besiege Acre in the Holy Land, would have been a nightmare for Saladin, particularly as many of the emirs of the north sort of circle around Aleppo were not very good friends of his, and they could see the opportunity, to break away. All that would have shaken Saladin's empire, and who knows, he might have come to terms. You have to remember that both sides in the Third Crusade were actively negotiating. They were actively negotiating, and the Crusaders were hoping that they could actually negotiate the freedom of Jerusalem. Well, perhaps with a German army coming down, they would have been able to. Who knows? I mean, it's speculation purely. In terms of the impact upon the political and military situation of the Third Crusade, Barbarossa, although he never made it to the Holy Land, did have a very considerable influence.
Now, I want to skip a few generations because the next emperor, the next Hohenstaufen emperor as well, famously don't get along with the Pope either. And that is, of course, Frederick II. But before we go into the Pope's relationship with Frederick, I want to understand because he is such one of my personal favorite Hohenstaufen emperors. And let's talk a little bit about the background of Frederick because he grew up in Sicily and let's talk about this impact of Sicily because, as we know, it was a Muslim part of the Caliphate of the Fatimid Caliphate until the Norman conquest, and it would be ruled by the Normans. And it wasn't that long that it had been under Norman rule, so it was still a very diverse part of the Arabs and Christians and Jews going along, maybe not going along all the time, but there were a mix of races, Normans, Arabs, and Jews in Sicily. So let's talk about how the impact of growing up with this diversity of Frederick II in Sicily, and let's talk about how this would impact him later. But of course, when we talk about his own crusade to the Holy Land, and let's talk about which we will talk about later, but let's talk about Frederick's upbringing in Sicily.
Right. Sicily had been conquered by Norman adventurers in the 11th century. Essentially, they'd married into the local nobility and then taken them over. So that Sicily, south of the river Garigliano, which is about 100 miles south of Rome, came under the sway of these northern Europeans. Southern Italy and Sicily. The Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, as it later became. That kingdom was, it occupied a space claimed by the Byzantine Empire in Constantinople, that is Istanbul, claimed by the Western Empire, and in a certain sense, claimed to be a subordinate kingdom of the papacy. So this is a very sensitive area. The Normans brought with them a Northern European heritage, but they also inherited a large Greek population, very large Greek population, and even nowadays there are churches which retain that Greek tradition in the south. In Sicily, particularly, there was a substantial Muslim settlement because Sicily, down to the Norman conquest, was Muslim. It wasn't necessarily a majority of the population even then, but it was substantial. Of course, they drifted away from Islam under Christian influence in the course of the 11th and 12th centuries. It's a fascinating place because the Norman kings of Sicily created a kind of composite civilization, Islamic, Greek, Latin, a civilization of the north of Europe, of Islam, and of the Greek East. It's a fascinating place, and their architecture is splendid. And anybody who goes to Sicily can see it in their churches and their grand survivals. This kingdom effectively came to a staggering halt in the 1190s because of the failure of the line of its kings. Frederick Barbarossa was succeeded by his son Henry VI, who had a rather short life. Henry VI married the heiress to the throne of Sicily, of the two Sicilies, Constance. The assumption was, because she was quite elderly, i.e., in her 30s, she would never have a child. But at the age of 40, which is astonishing, she produced an heir to Henry VI. The heir, the child, Frederick II, as he's later known, Frederick of Stupor Mundi, the wonder of the world. He was born in 1194. So many rumours swept around Sicily and Italy and Germany about her pregnancy. There was such doubt that when she went south to have the child in Italy, she was followed by a huge suite of diplomats and important people. And when she went into labour, they all crammed into the same room to watch the child being born.
No pressure there.
Lo and behold, the child of Henry VI is Frederick II. Now, Henry VI almost very promptly dies. He became ill. He died of an illness. So there is an immediate conflict in Germany. And there's an immediate conflict in the two Sicilies as to who should be the king there. It's a very sharp conflict. And the papacy emerges as a key factor. Pope Innocent III claims to be the ward of the young Frederick. And the papacy dislike the Hohenstaufen. Frederick Barbarossa and Henry VI have been very domineering, and they wanted to make sure that the King of Sicily would never be the same person as the Emperor of Germany. This proved, in the end, very difficult. And Innocent III, ultimately, in the chaos of Italy, backs Frederick, the young Frederick, as king, not only of Sicily, though he has to promise to give that up, but also of Germany. So that emerging out of several rather complex wars around about the year 1212, the German nobility and church are persuaded to opt for Frederick II of Hohenstaufen as king and therefore ultimately emperor. And he's allowed to retain Sicily. So that the nightmare of the papacy, the nightmare which has pursued it for centuries, has now come about. That Frederick is not the child of the church. He's a brilliant young man, very able and very ambitious. And like any other king, he's looking for power. In Germany, the minority rule has ruined Hohenstaufen power. In northern Italy, the cities are divided, but he has great wealth in the south. And he proves to be a brilliant soul organizer. And by the constitutions of Melfi, really, of 1223, he reforms the kingdom, makes himself an absolute monarch, has a brilliant court, is one of the most astonishingly cultivated rulers in Europe, and is also very, very orthodox. Great, he never creates an anti-pope. His dispute with the papacy is the same old dispute. The papacy is paranoid about domination from the south or the north, and fears this kind of pincer movement in the Italian peninsula. And in the end, Frederick is not prepared to sacrifice either of his titles. And to make matters worse, a lot of the cities of the Lombard plain, fed up with the dominion of Milan and the threat of constant warfare, turn to him for support. So Frederick becomes a real menace to the papacy.
No, I do
What
believe,
do you?
as sorry for interrupting you again, but I do believe as well, because like we talked about, there was quite a diverse community in Sicily. He was surrounded by Arabs and Jews and Christians, among other things. So I do believe there was a rumor as well that actually, because he enjoyed the Islamic prayer so much, as we will later see when he is in Jerusalem, there was, I do believe, rumors as well that he was really a Muslim, that he converted to Islam as well, and that so there were rumors spread around as well because of this, because diversity in those times was not, it's not the same as we praise this diversity today. Diversity was frowned upon in those days, and if you were surrounded by other infidels, if you will, you were just as bad as one yourself.
You must realize that the papacy was a great spreader of gossip and lies. It had the
Pretty
facility
much like the sun. In other words.
to do this because it communicated across the whole of Europe. There's no evidence at all that Frederick was anything but a very orthodox Christian. One thing that really shows this is that when he discovered there were heretics, in his realms, he pursued them ruthlessly in Germany and in Italy and in Sicily. He was an orthodox man in the religious sense, but in a cultural sense, he was perfectly prepared to get on with Muslims. He had a friendship with the Sultan of Egypt, for example. He cultivated the diversity of culture in the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies very happily. He himself is said to have written, there is a treatise on falconry, which is attributed to Frederick, of all things. And falconry, of course, was an art especially associated with the Arabs. Though it was popular across Europe. He was a very exotic figure in some ways, may well have spoken languages which were not known in the rest of Europe. And it was easy to make up stories about him. But those stories, by and large, are, well, they're by and large lies, actually. He nonetheless thrived on this, and he acquired the famous title Stupor Mundi, the wonder of the world, because not only was he a great emperor and a military leader, all the conventional things, he was also a highly sophisticated and civilized person. And this was a new kind of king to Europe, and therefore he stood out as somebody very strange and exotic, and at the same time, somebody who regarded as a bit suspect, and the papacy thrived on that and spread stories, or at least papal supporters did, even if the Pope didn't directly lie. But his great problem in the early part of his reign was the crusade. When he was crowned King of Germany, he took the cross in gratitude, he said. And as a sign of his faith in God.
What as and again, sorry to interrupt you, but there again, it's my understanding as well that the Pope, of course, as we said, they spread rumors, but he was planning to give him an ultimatum where he was had so many days to prepare and go on this crusade, and if not, he would be excommunicated. So I do believe that really, when he went on the crusade, it was under excommunication, isn't that right?
Yes, and it's a complicated story. Frederick the Cross, after his coronation in Germany, and promised to go on crusade. That taking of the cross coincided with the great movement we call the Fifth Crusade. And the Fifth Crusade conquered Damietta in Egypt and was threatening Cairo itself. Frederick promised and repeated his promise several times that he'd go on crusade, but never did. And the failure of the Fifth Crusade was in many quarters blamed on the failure of Frederick to fulfill his promise and go to the east. So the papacy had, as it were, a handle on Frederick by 1220 with the failure of the Fifth Crusade. He therefore had to give a high priority to crusading, but he also had to reorganize his realms, which had been considerably shattered by succession disputes. And in the end, it wasn't really till the late 1220s that he was free to go on crusade. And at the last minute, as his fleet gathered, he fell ill again. And this time, the papacy excommunicated him for his failure to fulfill his oath to go on crusade. Now, by that time, the papacy was beginning to see Frederick as a real threat, as a man who was interfering in the affairs of the North Italian cities, who was threatening the papacy, they thought, the independence of the papacy in central Italy. So that the issue of the crusade gets caught up with the tensions with the papacy, and he's excommunicated. He goes off on crusade anyway.
And again, and I want to ask as well, then I don't know, why didn't Frederick, as his grandfather did, set up an anti-pope in instead, like, screw you, I'm gonna set up an anti-pope. Why didn't Frederick do this, go the same route that Barbarossa did?
Well, with the coming of the failure of the Third Crusade, going on crusade became a kind of expectation, and it became
I mean, the excommunication and everything. Why did he not choose like it, Barbarossa?
the excommunication of Frederick was very important in a way, because when he got to the Holy Land, the religious orders and people who didn't like him generally were perfectly prepared to act against him. His great strength was that he was a diplomat. He'd long established contact with the Sultan of Egypt, and he knew that the Ayyubid family, which ruled in the Middle East, was divided, and he played them off. So that although he had a relatively small army, he had a big bargaining chip in this rivalry between the Ayyubids of Damascus and Aleppo on the one hand, and the Egyptians on the other. And he played them off. And what he achieved was the surrender back to Christian hands for 10 years, 12 years, of Jerusalem. But despite this, he was reviled by the papacy, hated by many of the people in the Holy Land because he was an excommunicate.
Personally, to me, that's one of the things I admire about Frederick, that he actually managed to get Jerusalem through diplomacy and without shedding blood. And it's ironic that the papacy, of all things that preaches Christianity, hated that that it seemed to me that they wanted him to kill some Muslims instead of that wanted bloodshed instead of just diplomacy and handing over windows, spilling an inch of blood. It seemed like they actually wanted him to like go kill a few Muslims and then take Jerusalem by force. That seemed to be what they really wanted.
He's, I mean, it scandalized Europe. Europe didn't really know what to make of this. On the one hand, they got Jerusalem back for Christianity. On the other hand, the man who'd done it was an excommunicate. I think sophisticated leading people understood very clearly that the reason why he was an excommunicate was nothing to do with crusading, fundamentally. They knew that this was a product of the rivalry with the Pope. But most people wouldn't have realized that. And it was something of a shock. You have to realize that up to the Third Crusade, nobody negotiated. It was only with the Third Crusade that negotiation with the enemy began. The Fifth Crusade, the Fourth Crusade had gone elsewhere. The Fifth Crusade had gone to Egypt. And it had negotiated. Frederick negotiated, but much more successfully. But it still seemed a very bizarre thing to do. And it still seemed very strange, I think, to most Europeans. And it added to the exoticism of Frederick. And in addition to that, most of the kings of Europe were very doubtful about the threat to his kingship, which the papacy was increasingly offering. Looking at it from the English point of view, Henry III, the child of King John, was could he be deposed if he offended the papacy? Well, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Any king would have to hesitate at supporting a papacy which deposed what they regarded as a legitimate ruler. So the challenge which Frederick offered to the papacy was really very formidable. In fact, he doesn't seem to have had any intention of conquering Rome. I'm sure he could have done it, but he doesn't seem to have had any intention that way. But what he was trying to do was effectively to unify Italy around the papacy. And that was his great offence. It was an offence in the face of the papacy. And of course, it had an enormous effect on northern Italy, where opinion in the cities divided between Frederick and the papacy. And the conflict of Guelph and Ghibelline, as it's called, became ever more violent, resulting in a sort of permanent war, which went on really till the 14th century. So Frederick is an extraordinary figure, a very powerful figure, and he has an immense influence on history in the 13th century.
So, in the aftermath of Frederick, how was it viewed by later medieval historians, and how will with the excommunication and with the, of course, famous story that he wanted to hear the Friday prayer when he entered Jerusalem and it was cut off because they felt disrespected him. And all these things that, he almost had the tolerance of other religion. And how was this viewed by chroniclers and of his time after his death? And how was the legacy of Frederick in his time in the 12th and 13th, 14th century viewed by chroniclers and historians of the day?
Most historians of the 13th century were very profoundly hostile to Frederick. Matthew Paris in England, for example, although he clearly understood all the issues, he's a very intelligent, very well-informed person. Nonetheless, in the end, it was the papacy that mattered. The papacy in the 13th century has, in a certain sense, achieved what had been struggling for nearly 200 years, And that was a clear recognition of its absolute supremacy, not day-to-day power, but ultimate supremacy over Europe. That it was, in a sense, the leader of the European Latin Catholic world. And that was accepted by the 13th century. And in many ways, Frederick was struggling against the current of contemporary thought. There were lots of people who didn't like what was happening to the papacy. But nonetheless, it's very difficult to see the 13th century except as the century of the popes. They are so dominant in European history in the 13th century, and Frederick stands against them at his peril. And in the end, they managed to recruit enough people, really, to prevent him achieving his goals. And of course, afterwards, the papacy pursues the Hohenstaufen, that generation of vipers, they call them, that generation of vipers, by destroying all Frederick's heirs and killing them.
So what would you say the rehabilitation, if you will, of Frederick began? That, hey, maybe he actually was quite a decent emperor and he wasn't this villainous and heretic as the hostile sources say he was, that he actually seemed to be kind of ahead of his time, you know, in a way. In my view, he kind of was ahead of his time. So when did if you will, for lack of better words, rehabilitation of Frederick II begin?
Well, really, by the early 14th century, the papacy had got itself into a great deal of disrepute. And as the 14th century went on, its malignancy and its problems become very, very clear. The movement from Rome to Avignon, the great division between Avignon and Rome with two popes for 100 years, all that tends to make people look at Frederick rather differently. And the real rebirth of Frederick's reputation, of course, is modern, because to modern liberal European thinking, he seems a gifted and able ruler who, you know, stands out. I think we tend to exaggerate him a bit. He was very different from other kings, but here is an orthodox ruler who persecutes heretics as much as, say, St. Louis of France. He didn't step outside the boundaries of his age, very few men do. But what he did show was that the European tradition of monarchy was flexible and could create a different kind of state from the clerical states of Northern Europe, which was a remarkable achievement, really. I've always been a great admirer of Frederick, not least because of the beauties that he left behind in southern Italy, which are remarkable. But he was, in the end, we shouldn't deceive ourselves, he was a medieval king with medieval priorities, and that included orthodoxy, orthodox Christianity.
When the Habsburgs took over after the Hohenstaufen dynasty, and when the Hohenstaufen were extinguished, they would hold the throne pretty much until Napoleon came and ended the whole Roman Empire. How did the early Habsburg relationship with after the extinction of the Hohenstaufen, how did the, well, was it immediately like repaired in a sense with the empire and papacy? What was the relation? Was it a little bit sour? Were there skepticism in the papacy that maybe they would be just like the Hohenstaufen? Or what was the relationship like when the Habsburg began to take the throne of the empire?
It was a very strained relationship. The empire and the papacy continued to quarrel, but by the 14th century, the empire, in the sense of Germany, Italy, was visibly failing in power. And by the early 14th century, the papacy was falling into disrepute as a result of its own division. So that the quarrels and the excommunications and all the rest of it of German emperors goes on essentially as a local dispute. It's no longer the focus of Europe. The focus of Europe has changed. And in the 14th century, the focus of Europe is on the great conflict of England and France. It's no longer the papacy, and the papacy is a marginal factor in that, quite an important factor diplomatically, but nonetheless, it doesn't have the same weight and it doesn't have the same involvement that the papacy of the 12th and 13th centuries had. The papacy and the empire are no longer the center of European development and conflict. That's shifted elsewhere, and the papacy is playing a much less notable role.
I think we're going to end it up there. Before we go, when you mentioned your book in the beginning about the monarchy in France and the military history of the French monarchy, when is the book coming out, and when can people expect to pre-order if they will, or if they want to read about the French military history?
Sorry, there was a blur in the...
When is your book on French military history, and what is it called, and when is it coming out, so people can pre-order it or order it online or in the bookshops if they want to read about French military history?
It's a history of it's a military history of the French monarchy from 885 to 1305. And it's an attempt to look at the way in which French military achievement, which by the end of the 13th century is enormous, how was this military ascendancy of the French monarchy achieved? Was it the result of the strength of the French monarchy or the weakness of others? And how was it that the French monarchy created this idea of great military strength, and how did it use that military strength, and how did it project it? And one of the great problems I faced is how to define what's France, because Franque, the Latin term, does not mean French really in origin, but it's an attempt to explore the growth of French military power. By 1300, France was the single most important military army, single most important army in the whole of Europe. And yet, at the beginning of that period, about 900, France barely existed. So it's an exploration of that phase of French monarchical development and its military aspects. Because if you're a great king, if you're a king, you've got to win. Mm-hmm. Put very crudely, you really have got to win. And the French monarchy managed it.
Thank you so much for coming in. It's been a great pleasure to have you to discuss this topic today. This has been Where That Aged Well. We are available on social media under Where That Aged Well on Twitter/X. And Instagram under Where That Aged Well. They are available on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you're on Spotify, please rate us 5 stars if you like this episode, and also check out some other episodes. If you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review on the podcast, and I will try to read it out on the podcast at the beginning or the end of an episode if I see the review. If you're on YouTube, like, share, and subscribe for more stuff like this. My name is Alan. This has been With That Aged Well. I do hope you hear a clear difference. I'm sorry if I may have slurred it today and apologize, but I hope the new microphone really shows a difference of the quality of the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been With That Aged Well. I'll see you next time.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.